body.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the Big Travel Podcast, exploring life stories through travel. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Thanks so much for all the comments and the podcast love. I'm loving too the reviews on iTunes, so please keep them coming. If you haven't already done so, please also subscribe. It's absolutely free and you'll get the podcast sent to you every Tuesday. Now, on the 16th of May 2017, at 4:45 a.m, in temperatures of minus 35 degrees centigrade, Molly Hughes reached the summit of Mount Everest. Aged just 26, this was her second time at the peak of Everest. She became the youngest woman in the world and the first English woman to successfully summit both the north and south sides of the world's highest mountain. Molly's seen the world in ways most of us can only dream of, and she has a brilliant tale to tell of her life so far in travel.
I think we should start on top of the world. How does it feel when you're standing on top of the world?
Yeah. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. You can see the whole of the Himalayas, the whole of Nepal and Tibet's brought out beneath you. But it's not exactly how, you know, how in songs it's always like talking about this euphoric moment of being on top of the world. But it's not like that. You're like so physically and mentally exhausted from the journey up there. And the lack of oxygen just takes everything from you. So it's definitely not a euphoric moment, but it's an amazing one, and one I'll always remember. But you feel that kind of euphoria a little bit more when you're down and you're safe and you're off the mountain.
Were you scared at any point?
Every day.
Yeah.
Almost every minute of every day, probably.
What's the most terrifying thing?
For me, it's probably heights. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of heights.
You've got into the wrong business.
Yeah, definitely gone the wrong path. Yeah. But no, it's okay. Like, I mean, well, on Everest there's obviously lots of heights. So one of the worst things on Everest are the crevasses. So on the south side, in the Kumbi Waterfall, you've got these huge, like, gaping crevasses. Maybe like 3, 4, 5 metres wide and 50 metres deep. And you just cross them on like ladders, like normal ladders that you have in your shed at home, strung together. They're pretty horrible and pretty scary for someone that has the fear of heights.
And also you must be carrying a lot of equipment, have thick gloves on.
Yeah, exactly.
So crawling across a ladder.
Yeah, yeah.
How deep is it below in the crevasse?
Well, down to, I don't know, 50 metres. They look pretty much bottomless from where we are. I mean, there's a safety line that runs across it. Well, when I was on that side of the mountain in 2012, there was one particularly bad one. And yeah, I guess it is dangerous because one chap did unfortunately die in one of them. The Sherpa, so one of these local Nepalese guides, these incredible people. And he was, I don't know if he was like in a rush to get down because he was coming back from camp one, back to base camp, crossing one of these ladders. And for some reason he didn't clip into the safety line. I guess he was in a rush, or maybe he got a bit like complacent because he'd done it so often. But he slipped on the ladder and fell all the way to the bottom of the crevasse. He died on that fall, unfortunately. So it is dangerous, but it's all about taking it slowly and not being kind of overwhelmed by that fear that you feel.
In your film, Beyond the Highest Peak, that you made from your last visit, your 2017 climb of Everest, you describe finding a body on the path.
Yeah, so that's on the north side from last year. And on the final summit day, like way up above 8,000 metres, so way up in the death zone. Yeah, I saw a few bodies last year, and one particularly bad one, or particularly close. It was very close to where we were climbing up, and you could see all of him, and he was kind of dressed just like we were. Same kind of high altitude suit, the same boots. He looked just like one of our team members, but he was obviously not alive anymore, and he was frozen. So yeah, it was pretty harrowing.
What has happened to people? What is the death zone? I've never heard of that.
So the death zone is kind of a phrase, I guess, used by climbers and people to describe the area above 8,000 metres. So Everest is 8,848 metres. So that final, like, almost 850 metres, you're climbing in this area where, like, human life or any life can't really survive for long. Yeah, your body's kind of dying on itself when you're up there because there's, like, a third less oxygen than there is down here at sea level. So it's kind of somewhere you want to spend, like, as little time as possible. But saying that, you have to spend a long time up there. The first time on the south side, maybe 18 or 20 hours up there. And then this year, I don't know, it must have been a good 14 or 15. So it's somewhere you've got to be in your body. You can just feel it just zapping everything from your body up there.
How many days does it take?
The whole Everest expedition from either the north or the south side takes 2 months. And up on the route, on the south side, there's 4 camps before the summit. And the north side, there's 3 on the way up. Well, 4 main ones. And we kind of spend a lot of time kind of yo-yoing up and down the mountain during those 2 months. So we'll kind of go from base camp at the bottom, which is reasonably comfy, up to camp 1, back down, you'll rest and recover. You then go up to camp 2, down again, you'll rest and recover.
I don't understand why you're coming back down. No, that down just again. Seems counterintuitive to me.
Yeah, just retracing your steps the whole time. It's all about the altitude. Because there's such little oxygen up there, we slowly let our bodies acclimatise. And after like 5 or 6 weeks, yeah, we get much better at the altitude. And that's when you can kind of start to think about going all the way to the top. Because at first, when you first start that first trip up to Camp 1, you're just suffering every step and you're just thinking, there's no way I'm ever going to make it all the way up there. But doing these like rotations on the mountain slowly gets you acclimatised.
What motivates you to put yourself through that?
Lots of things. I mean, I'm obviously talking a lot about the suffering part of it and the danger, but that's kind of a very small part of it to me. And what it's all about is, well, a few things. It's definitely about the achievement, but it's also about the experience of being in these incredible places. The Himalayas, and especially when you get up high in the Himalayas, is just the most breathtaking place. You just got like huge white peak mountains surrounding you, incredible sunsets, incredible sunrises. The stars at night are just like nothing you've ever seen before. Yeah, it's the most inspiring place in the world. And when you can get all the way up to the top of it and look down on this huge mountain range, yeah, that's what really motivates me.
Who are you with? Who are your companions on these trips?
So last year on the north side, I had a really great team. There was just 4 of us. So it was myself and my friend called John Gupta, who is a mountain guide. And I was kind of saying my plans to go to Everest, north side, and just asked if he would be interested in coming in and kind of guiding the expedition. And he was, yeah, really keen. And then we had 2 local Nepalese guides with us. One of them was a chap I hadn't met before called Leela, who was brilliant. And then the other guy was Lakpo Onju Sherpa, who is a really good friend of mine, and he's the guy that I summited with on the south side back in 2012. Actually, I've climbed all of my kind of big peaks in the Himalayas with Lakpa. So me and John shared a tent most of the way up, and yeah, he's a fun guy. He had some good banter, which kept it fresh.
On a practical sense, what are you eating? How did you have to carry everything with you?
Yeah, so like at base camp, it's okay. Like as I said, it's a little bit more comfy down there, so like reasonable meals. But like on the way up, it's just like freeze-dried meals. So like army ration pack type things, you're pouring water into it. As we're heading up on our summit attempt this year, we're like packing all our food bags. And like by the time we got up there, I kind of realised that all we'd really packed were these like packets of chicken tikka curry. So like the last like 4 days, all we had to eat were these horrible chicken tikka curry. And it's the last thing you want to eat when you're up at 8,000 metres.
You must really need your energy, though. You must really have to take that into account. How do you train before the 2 months?
Just as much as possible. Like, being as fit as possible is important. I live up in Scotland, so it's quite easy to get out into the mountains and make training like, quite specific. But then also, like, gym stuff. It all helps, definitely. And also, yeah, I think maybe being a little bit heavier when you go into these kind of trips, any kind of big mountain trips or polar trips, because you kind of burn like almost 10,000 calories a day out there. So it's impossible to eat all of that, so you're definitely relying on your muscle and fat reserves quite a lot.
Did you come back very thin?
Yeah, I think I lost tired 5 kilograms last year on it in 2 months.
It's a long time to be away from your friends and family and day-to-day life, though.
Definitely is, but I think it's harder for them, a lot harder for them than it is for me.
Has anyone ever said to you, I don't want you to go?
Never, no. Which is really good. I'm sure they've all thought it, parents and everyone, but it's good that they don't say that.
What is the difference between the north side and the south side of Everest?
Yeah. So the south side, you climb up from Nepal. It's definitely the more popular route, but the north side is from Tibet, and that's the original route that British teams were trying to climb in the 1920s, but it was finally summited later than the south side. And the north side is colder and windier, a bit more technical, the climbing. It's a bit harder, much more rock to climb. and you spend more time up in the death zone, that nice place that we talked about. So yeah, the north side that I did last year was definitely more challenging, but incredible, really incredible.
And how did you get into it? So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Devon, right on the south coast, like as far from mountains as you get really in the UK. And we did like lots of outdoorsy stuff growing up. Did some hiking and surfing and stuff. But then kind of mountains kind of came into my life when I was 17, and I went on this expedition to Kenya, and we kind of explored a bit, did some charity work, and then had the chance to climb Mount Kenya, which is amazing. It was kind of like 4 or 5 days of just like walking uphill, a reasonable altitude, and then like getting to the top, the clouds were all swelling around me, like, yeah, I was hooked from that moment. So I just kept kind of going throughout the rest of school and uni, saving up as much money as I could and heading off on trips around the world, climbing in different mountain ranges. After Kenya, I went off to the Himalayas in India for the first time, which, yeah, was incredible. The scale of it definitely blew my mind as an 18-year-old. And then the following year, I started uni and kind of spent a lot of my student loan that next summer on going off to the Andes and climbing there. And then also we went to North Africa, the Atlas Mountains that year. And then the year after, we went back to East Africa. And then, like, close to home in the Alps and in Scotland, just as much as I could. And
do you go on normal holidays as well? I mean, can I find you flat out on the beach in Costa del Sol?
Not for very long. Like, I can handle, like, lying on a beach for, like, a day. But much, much more than that, then, yeah, I need a bit of a mountain or something to climb.
So apart from Everest, where's been the most incredible place you've been in the world?
Oh, good question. So many incredible places. I love Africa. I've only been, like, 3 times to Kenya and Tanzania and Morocco a couple of times, and it's amazing. It's just so different to life here. And I remember the first time I went when I was 17, yeah, it definitely just blew my mind. Just this completely different culture, all these amazing people that just seem to just, yeah, be so excited about life. It's so different, but yeah, so great.
You're going to some unusual places and people don't tend to go on holiday. Have you ever felt threatened in any way in these places, or vulnerable?
You know, a little bit. I mean, I'm usually with, you know, a group of really great people, travellers or climbers, so never that much. And I think especially the more you visit places, like, so, like, especially Nepal, because I've been there so much recently. I think I've been, like, 4 times in the last 4 years. And the more you get to know a place, the more you realise that they're not threatening or scary. They're just incredible, and you've got to kind of adjust to their pace. And then as soon as you do, you realise the wonders that are there, I guess.
Do you think it makes you pretty fearless?
Not fearless. I'm definitely scared a lot still, travelling or climbing. But it just helps you learn to control it and take it a bit more rationally.
What's the best thing about travelling? What does it do for you?
A few things. I guess it makes you a lot more humble. It makes you often appreciate what you've got at home. But it also just kind of opens up your mind to different people and how they live their life and how maybe you can live your life in a different way, a better way.
You're also a motivational speaker. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I started doing talks after my first summit of Everest in 2012. And at first it was just like small little things, like my old school invite me back and the local WI group, I went and spoke to them. And then I just kind of built it from there. And now I do all sorts of things, like loads of travelling around different schools around the country. And then also corporate stuff as well. I'm off to Barcelona next month for my like first international gig for this big medical company, which should be really fun. But yeah, just trying to grow out as much as I can and share my story. But I guess in a way, because obviously Everest, it seems so big and out of people's minds or thoughts of, that they can achieve something. But I guess I try and make these talks, I'll show them about my story of climbing Everest, but then how they can also achieve things in their lives. It doesn't have to be climbing, it can be anything that they've got passion for.
Talk me through the process. How do you convert that mountaineering experience to motivating someone who's working in computers?
So I tend to kind of run my presentations around like a few key themes. One of them is like self-belief. And I talk quite a lot about the difference between like self-belief and self-confidence, and how when I was younger, when I was like at school, I was like one of the shyest kids in the class. I would never like put my hand up and answer a question. And if the teacher asked me a question, I would always just like be really embarrassed. So I never had that much self-confidence. But I always had this like deep down belief that I could do something and achieve something, even if I didn't show it to other people. So I always try to make sure people can understand that difference. Like, just because you're on the outside, you're not kind of overtly showing people that you can achieve, you still can have these ambitions. And then I also talk about stuff like controlling fear, like we spoke about perseverance, which is definitely the most important thing for getting to the top of the world in the whole journey. And yeah, teamwork as well.
Have you got any examples of how you've managed to sort of turn people around with that?
You know, it's like after I visit schools, I always get nice emails or tweets from some of the students. And it's always hard to know, like, once you leave a building, a school or event, like, what happens the other side and how you've had that kind of impact on people. But I had a really nice one that I got told about just before Christmas. I did this talk for this like bank in Scotland, and it was kind of open to all of their staff in this bank. And one of the cleaning ladies came. She was this Polish lady, and she came along to the talk as well because she was really interested by the poster advertising it. And like a few weeks later, she was talking to the organizer, who obviously organized the whole thing with me. She told her that she'd actually like now quit her job at this bank as a cleaner, and she was going to go back to Poland and go back to university to start her own business, which is really cool. And she said, because she was inspired by my talk, and that you can just achieve anything, and that like now's the time to do it. It was really humbling to hear that side of it.
Must be so nice to actually find that just your experience and relating it to people can actually make a difference to individual people's lives.
Yeah, it just shows that even if she's the only one that I managed to motivate, I hope there's more, but you know, it's worth it.
Where in the world would you like to go that you haven't been? What's next on your list? What's your dream destination as well?
I'm not sure about my dream destination. I think things just kind of come up, or places to visit, or mountains that I'm interested in. One day I'd really like to go to Antarctica. It looks like the most incredible, barren, crazy landscape.
So that's appealing, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just
thinking it looks very cold.
Cold's okay, I can deal with cold.
Can you? Do you not feel the cold?
Not as much as most other people.
It's about having the right equipment, I guess. Yeah, I don't have good equipment even for British winters.
And it's having good clothing for sure.
And what would you do in Antarctica? Because it's not about climbing there, I'm assuming. It's about trekking.
I mean, there are some cool mountains, but yeah, or it's like about skiing. Obviously, you can ski to the South Pole, which would be interesting. Well, yeah, there's some cool mountains to have a look at as well.
When you go on holiday or in a trip, is it always about mountain climbing or doing something adventurous?
It's always some kind of adventurous theme to it, but not always about mountains. I've just booked one for March. And I'm going to Jordan with two other like adventure girls. These are really cool girls. And we're doing this like desert crossing, which is going to be completely out of my comfort zone. It's hot. It's going to be like, we're trying to do about 275 kilometres, just like self-supported, so carrying everything ourselves. It's going to be interesting. I think it's one of those things I just kind of joined on a whim and thought, that sounds like fun. And then when I get there and it's like 40 degrees.
You're in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
How will you make sure you're safe? Have you got a backup plan?
A little bit. I mean, like the whole idea of this trip is, I think, to show that people can go off and travel around these places, and especially women on their own, and it is all really accessible, and it's a beautiful country, and it's a shame to not want to go to somewhere like that for any kind of, you know, media headlines or whatever. In terms of a backup plan, we'll have safety get outs, we'll have a good GPS and communication with people.
There was that man that was lost recently in the jungle somewhere for several days, and he was all over the news, and I don't think he took anything with him, which is a little bit selfish.
I mean, you know, mountaineering and this kind of expedition is generally quite selfish. Like, the only person that really benefits from it is the person that's there, seeing these things and these incredible things, which is a bit of a shame, but I think it's probably something I've come to accept in a way. And I guess I try and offset it by coming back and talking to as many kids as I can and trying to inspire them a little bit.
Do you have any interest in, say, something that might go hand in hand, like conservation, when you're travelling?
Absolutely. And I think like one of my main interests is people, so I always try and, if I've got a big trip, try and raise money for a different charity. Last year on Everest, I raised money for cancer research, and we raised like 13,500 in the end, which was really great. And then the first Everest trip, I raised money for ActionAid. So yeah, I quite like people charity. You know, I love animals, I love the planet, but there's just something about people when they need help.
How do you finance these trips?
It's the hardest thing. Yeah, absolutely. So climbing Everest on either route, the north or the south, can cost anywhere between like £30,000 and £80,000 per person. Huge amounts of money. So I always have to try and get corporate sponsorship. So I want to get big companies on board to give me the funding in return for anything really, for marketing, PR opportunities, going in and doing talks with them, their customers. It's definitely harder than climbing the mountain itself, raising that amount of money. Like when I was trying to raise it all for 2017, it took about 3 years. You're just constantly getting rejected from companies, constantly like hitting dead ends. But yeah, in the end we got it.
You were only 21 the first time you climbed Everest. You're the youngest woman in the world to climb it from both sides, the north and south. And you, what else are you?
I'm also the first English woman to do it from both sides.
At 21, climbing Everest, how old are people that go up there? Yeah. Are there 21-year-olds that are doing
this? Yeah, there are absolutely. Not many. But there are a few. Like when I was on it, there was a team of, there was like another 21-year-old, another 20,
ideas.
So when I was on it the first time, yeah, there was a group of youngish people, which was really nice. So we all kind of similar backgrounds and similar ambitions. You know, I think due to the cost of it and all the training and experience that's needed, obviously it kind of is more of a thing that's commonly done by a slightly older people, usually men. But yeah, it's nice when you get young people going for it as well.
Do the old school men that encounter you up the mountain, yeah, are they quite surprised by your presence?
I don't think so, not these days. It's definitely like, as a woman, you're definitely in the minority on these mountaineering trips. And at base camp last year, there were hardly any women at base camp, which is interesting, but like, it's, you know, it's fine. I can work with men very easily. You can get on and you know, you're there to climb it and get the job done.
Is it one of these things with women that actually women aren't as good at climbing as men because of sheer issues with physical strength?
No. No, definitely not. Women can get as strong as men if they want, but training. And also at altitude, things kind of even out a little bit. And I think sometimes women seem to cope a little bit better than men. In climbing these mountains, these big mountains, is so many things are kind of balanced to either success or fail. So it is to do with how physically strong you are, how much training you've done. It's all to do with how well you adapt. But it's also so much about the psychology of it. And if you can not be overwhelmed by this huge objective, and if you can break it down, and if you can think really rationally and pragmatically and not focus on the top. And I think it's more about the mental side of it than it is the physical side.
Now, I first met you in a castle in Spain at the wedding of the twin sister of your partner, Jess. Describe the castle to me.
It's a crazy place, isn't it? Yeah,
it's really fabulous.
Where Jess and Kate's dad has lived there the last, I don't know how long, 10, 15 years? And it's like a 13th century castle on a hilltop above the Costa del Sol. It's beautiful. It's kind of... there's a hotel there, but it's not like a touristy destination much. There's just these, like, I think there's 15 residents or something that live there permanently, and most of them are like old German hippies with like three teeth, and then a few little restaurants, and it's just, yeah, a beautiful and different world.
Is that where you go to relax? Where do you go for fun?
Yeah, we go to Spain quite a lot. We go and see Jess's dad, mainly for the beer and the food and the sunshine, but for fun, I don't know, I enjoy, climbing is fun for me. So going up into the mountains of Scotland, I would much rather do that than, I don't know, go shopping for the day. I don't know what normal girls do for fun, but yeah, I'd much rather go off and spend the weekend, yeah, in the hills than going on nights out or whatever.
You live in Edinburgh, so does that give you a lot of opportunities to go out into the mountains, yeah, and absolutely, highlands, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of one of the main reasons why I live there. I'm so close to these incredible mountains. Scotland has some beautiful and challenging mountains, these incredible coastlines. It's all accessible, but you can still be in a beautiful capital city.
One of the reasons why, certainly for me and a lot of people I speak to, don't travel so much in the UK, mm-hmm, is because the weather is so unpredictable. But that obviously doesn't seem to bother you.
Yeah, it's okay. Like, it's hard because, like, obviously Scotland is renowned for being wet and the weather being not so great. But when... you do get these days in Scotland where the weather is perfect, it's sunny, it's warm, there's no wind. It's the best place in the world. You probably couldn't find anywhere better than in Scotland. We had an amazing trip a couple of years ago to the Outer Hebrides. So I kind of spent 2 weeks kind of travelling up and down the length of the Outer Hebrides, going through all these different islands, travelling by ferry across them. And for a good, probably half the time, the weather was just completely perfect. It was really like 24 degrees and really hot. And it just looks like the Caribbean, but in Scotland. It's beautiful. It's absolutely incredible.
There's stunning places in the UK, and Wales, you know, the beaches in Wales, yeah, are just fantastic.
Absolutely.
Massive expanses of white sand,
yeah,
but
yeah,
stand on them and you're in a gale.
Yeah, you could get them on a good day, for sure.
What's next then? You're going to Jordan. What else are you
Jordan,
doing?
And then I guess the next main thing I'm kind of focusing on is I'm doing some work with a charity up in Scotland called the Polar Academy. This is a really cool charity founded... 4 or 5 years ago by this polar explorer called Craig Matteson. He's this amazing guy. He's been to the South Pole, the North Pole, all the poles. And he basically kind of saw this kind of opportunity or this gap where in schools, this huge group of kids that kind of see themselves a little bit as invisible. So it's not like the really clever kids or the really sporty kids. It's not the naughty, trouble kids that get all the attention and all the funding. It's this kind of middle group where maybe the teachers don't know their names. They just come in every day, keep their head down. Maybe they've been bullied. Maybe their home lives aren't great. And he basically goes in to different schools, just in Scotland at the moment, but hoping to expand, and identifies a group of these kids and trains them up for a year. Turns them from, really shy kids with hardly any self-confidence, super low self-esteem, kids that have usually not done much sport or exercise before, trains them for a year, turns them into these basically elite athletes, and then they go off on an expedition to Greenland. And they have this amazing, challenging expedition in Greenland. So I'm becoming part of that, and I'm training to be guide to take some of these students to Greenland in 2019, which will be incredible. I can't wait.
There's something inside you feel that you can relate to those children. Absolutely. From being that shy child.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely had a much easier time than a lot of the kids that we're working with, but it's definitely that atmosphere at school when you're in a big, huge school, the students in the class, they're getting all the attention for different random things, good things and bad things. But then these kids that just go in every day and never see themselves as kids that can achieve, I guess. They never view themselves. They will just carry on. They won't think about going to university. They won't think about big jobs or things that they can do in their lives. It's going to be really interesting to turn around their ambitions, I guess.
I imagine something like that can really turn people's lives around.
Yeah, it does. I've met the kids that have been on these expeditions the last couple of years, and they're incredible now. Now they can stand up in front of hundreds of people and give presentations about their experiences. Most of them are off to university now, where they wouldn't have imagined doing it before. Yeah, it completely changes them just by, I guess, empowering them and giving them this kind of sense of self-belief.
Tell me the difference between self-belief and self-confidence. I found that really interesting.
Yeah. So self-confidence, obviously that outward version of yourself, is what you present to other people. It might give you the ability to be really good in social situations or stand up and give these big presentations, talk in front of people. But self-belief is more than that. It's like a deep down feeling that you can really do something and you can really achieve something in your life. And self-belief, it doesn't have to be coupled with self-confidence. They don't necessarily have to go hand in hand. You can be self-confident but not really have that much self-belief. And you can definitely have self-belief but not have that self-confidence. And I think that's the really interesting one. Because once someone that has self-belief suddenly finds a bit of self-confidence as well, you can just achieve absolutely anything.
And do you think travel has a way of helping people bring out that self-belief and bring out the best?
Yeah, it's all about travel and challenge as well. And travel can be challenging. It puts you out of your comfort zone. And as soon as you step out of your comfort zone in any way, going to a new country, organising trips yourself, meeting people you wouldn't have met before, it definitely challenges you. And that kind of challenge and pushing yourself is where it all kind of starts to grow.
Something that I ask all my guests to finish up on is about music, because I adore travel and music, and I think the two of them go very much hand in hand. And I would like to know if there's any music that reminds you of anything particularly special, something you've taken with you on any of your journeys, and something you could share with us.
Okay, it's probably not a good or an accurate representation of my music choices.
It never is, and that's the fascinating thing about this question.
So, on the north side of Everest, last year, we kind of had this big, long climb all the way up to the North Col, and it's camp number one. It's 7,000 metres. And me and John going into our little tent, it'd been snowing all day. And it'd been a hard day, lugging everything up there. Got into our little tent, it just snowed all night. But as soon as you're in your tent and you're in your sleeping bag and the stove's on and you're cooking dinner, things can be okay. And we took up a little stereo and attached it to our phones. And we just listened to all of these 90s hits. And the one that kind of stood out the most was Britney Spears, Hit Me Baby One More Time, blasting out at 7,000 metres on the North Col of Everest as we were cooking our dinner in our tent.
Molly Hughes, thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much, Molly, and good luck with your next adventures. Thanks to Azimuth Post-Production in Soho for the use of the studio, and thanks to all of you for listening. Coming up in future episodes, we have some very interesting conversations for you from people from all walks of life and some very well-known people as well. We'll be giving you a new episode every Tuesday, and if you want them sent directly, do subscribe, and we would really appreciate it if you gave us a review on iTunes as well, because that helps push us up in the ranks. Thank you very much again, and see you next time on the Big Travel Podcast.